Welcome to the Irwin Markets Project.
This is Irwin Markets, Professor Emeritus of History, Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Today's topic is Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, and Eleanor Aveling, who is the daughter of Karl Marx. In dealing with Marx and Engels, although there is a class aspect, which is primary, there's also, to a limited extent, peripherally, a race and gender aspect. With race, it's mainly Marx commenting on the situation in the United States, and with gender, it's primarily the work of Friedrich Engels. Eleanor Aveling will be a brief footnote to indicate there's a generational aspect to the story, but the primary concentration will be on Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. They were partners for 4 decades. They came out of a German background. They spent a great deal of time living in Great Britain, Marx in London and Engels in Manchester. Both came out of a middle-class background. Marx's father was a lawyer. Engels' father was a manufacturer. However, their economic circumstances during their lifetime was very different. Engels did fairly well, had a reasonable income, while Marx was living in poverty and would have been in even worse shape without the financial contribution of Engels. The focus of both of them is on class struggle. Marx gets a PhD from German universities, I think from the University of Jena. He was born in 1818, died in 1883, lived 65 years. Also attended the University of Berlin, became a radical journalist, was moved by the plight of the workers. The workers in Silesia, for example, the workers who were comparable to the Luddites in Great Britain, those who were the handloom weavers, others in the Rhine Valley and other places in Germany also suffered, and Karl Marx became their champion. So Marx is interested in activism, he's interested in sociological ideas, he's interested in economic ideas, but he's also a philosopher. And when we talk about German philosophy in the 19th century, we begin with Hegel. Marx was influenced by Hegel, as were many other philosophers of Germany in the 19th century. He was impressed by Hegel's dialectical idealism, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. He was impressed by Hegel's having a viewpoint of change in history. On the other hand, he became, for a time, a left Hegelian, indicating that materialism, not idealism, was the key to understanding society, that the force of society, particularly economic forces, were the dominant element. The superstructure, which included philosophical ideas and other intangible aspects, was influenced, if not more than influenced, by economic features and material features of society. So Marx develops a dialectical materialism, a thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. He sees economic factors as being dominant, emphasizes the class struggle, begins with stages of history, primitive communism in the early stages, which was a system based on mutual aid, the group, common interest, but did not have the material basis to have a successful society, was the sharing of poverty rather than the sharing of plenty. The next stage is the classical stage, Greece and Rome, where you had class struggle, patricians and plebeians and other slaves and freemen, men and women. That was followed by feudalism, which was mainly an agrarian system. There was a landed class and serfs who worked for the lords. The lords had a relationship to each other, a relationship to the land, a relationship to the church, a relationship to the king. But a dynamic factor emerges within feudalism, which will be a buttress for a time, but eventually will be partly responsible for its downfall. That's the emergence of a commercial middle class, sometimes connected with trade, sometimes connected with banking, sometimes connected with proto-industrialization. What's going to happen is that the feudal class will be undermined, and there'll be the rise of capitalism, commercial capitalism, industrial capitalism, and eventually financial capitalism. This capitalist structure will be, in a sense, a very positive step forward. It'll be the most productive economy to this point in history. It'll have a dynamic group, the bourgeoisie, industrialists, railroad owners, merchants, bankers. They will operate as a new dominant class. The antithesis of the bourgeoisie, the merchants, and the industrial and transportation elite will be the proletariat. These industrial workers will be the antithesis. They will form unions. They will look for change. They will become revolutionaries under the leadership of the Communist Party. What Marx saw was that the system of capitalism had many important characteristics. It produced more than any other previous economic system. It had a larger geographical and territorial domain. It overcame the regionalism and the ruralism of the feudal society. It displaced feudalism as the dominant economic system. It had worldwide effectiveness as capitalism developed. Its production capacity exceeded its capacity to have the goods consumed. This underconsumption aspect led to capitalists, instead of paying workers more, going to other countries to get cheap labor, to get raw materials, to get investment opportunities. Eventually, this would be too demanding on the resources, too demanding on the people, too demanding on the investment opportunities, combined with the workers developing a class consciousness that they were the producers of wealth and were being paid a subsistence wage, were working in alienating conditions where they did not see the benefits of their labor. They did not get an opportunity for meaningful employment, meaningful production, creativity on the job. Their families were not able to sustain themselves very well. And these individuals saw an opportunity to make change by group means, by mutual aid, by solidarity. They formed unions. The Communist Party took the lead, pointed to the common interest over national boundaries and other political and cultural and ethnic limitations. And Marx proclaimed the Communist Manifesto, "Workers of the world, unite, you have nothing to lose by your chains, and hope for a revolution." In 1848, he was fairly confident the revolution had come. Began in Italy, spread to France, eventually spread to the Habsburg Empire, spread to Italy, spread to the Hohenzollerns in Prussia, spread to Baden, had a counterpart in a sense in Great Britain with the Chartist movement demanding universal manhood suffrage, annual parliament, and other changes to increase the power of the working class, the industrial working class, which was developing in Great Britain, which was the leading industrial power of the world at the turn of the mid-century. 1851, Crystal Palace Exposition represented an opportunity for the British, which they took advantage of, to display to the world their competency in industrialization and their leadership in that field. What we have then is a person, Karl Marx, who is interested in not only understanding the world, but changing the world. He's a philosopher, interested in the world of ideas, but he wants to get beyond that and understand what's happening in society, which is undergoing a major dramatic transformation in his lifetime. He expresses his views in the Philosophical and Economic Manuscripts of 1843-44, influenced by Hegel, the left Hegelians, Ludwig Feuerbach. He declares that the human beings, men, women, labor to produce wealth, but also labor to get the satisfaction of creativity. This is absent under capitalism. Alienation prevails. Workers are reduced to factors of production. They're not operating in a humanistic environment. Rather, they're operating in an environment which they're exploited, not only in terms of creating surplus value, which goes to the capitalist, while they achieve at most a bare subsistence. Marx denies that the system is fair. He sees himself as a scientific socialist, but at the same time, he has elements of the utopian socialist, although he is critical of them. There's a moralistic aspect as well as a scientific aspect, an ethical aspect to Karl Marx, although he at times doesn't view himself in that manner. He is influenced by the classical economists of Adam Smith, David Ricardo in particular. He draws from them and from John Locke and others the labor theory of value. Labor creates wealth, but doesn't get the wealth it's entitled to under the capitalist system. He also looks to the utopian socialists for their critique of capitalism, although he views them as being naive and idealistic in expecting that education and communes and phalanxes and communities will transform capitalism and end exploitation. In 1848, Marx and Engels write the Communist Manifesto, a short statement of the nature of history, class struggle, climaxing in the struggle between the capitalists and the workers, the existing struggle, which Marx hopes and expects will lead to the triumph of the workers going through a dictatorship of the proletariat and eventually emerging as the final society of communism. As Marx views communism, it's a society that has plenty, material goods, but that is not the goal, the essence of communism. The essence of communism is that there's a new value system, new way of life, a new ethical standard. Workers are now able to be creative, they're able to get leisure time, they're able to exercise their full humanity. There's been a transvaluation of values. Instead of being selfish and individualistic and materialistic, workers are now under the new system, according to Marx, going to be cooperative, productive, and creative. There are many other books by Marx and Engels. I'll mention a few. Engels lives in Manchester, which is the center of the industrialization of Great Britain, a textile center which produces a great deal of wealth, produces a new class of factory owners who are the new elite, produces a great deal of pollution, produces a great deal of crowdedness, produces a great deal of violence, produces a great deal of exploitation. This is the subject of Engels' work, Condition of the Working Class in England, in Great Britain, 1840s. He's not the first, not the only one to deal with this. Among others, Charles Dickens deals with the poverty and exploitation and crushing of the laboring class. Marx draws on the Blue Books, the Parliamentary Investigations, Parliamentary Investigation of 1833, the Sadler Report, the Parliamentary Investigation of 1847, deals with child labor, the labor of women, the labor of men, exploitation of the factories, exploitation of the fields, exploitation of the mines, exploitation of transportation workers. Marx becomes involved in the Revolution of 1848, supports the revolution, is disappointed in the outcome of the revolution. In France, there's a successful revolution in February 1848. The government of Louis Philippe, the bourgeois monarchy, which began in 1830 out of the Revolution of 1830, disappears, is overcome, is removed from power by a new group, looking more to the middle class and workers. However, there's a backlash, particularly with the army, with more conservative politicians. The army is crucial in the June days, along with peasantry and the elite, overcoming the workers, Louis Blanc, the national workshops, and Louis Napoleon, Napoleon III, will come to power and remain there until about 1870, when the Franco-Prussian War will lead to his elimination as the ruler of France. There are also revolutions in Italy, in Germany, in Austria, Hungary. These have initial success. They displace leadership. Metternich, for example, in the Habsburg Empire, is removed from power. The man who had been the power figure in Austria-Hungary for more than three decades since the defeat of Napoleon in 1850 is displaced in 1848. There's a revolution in Hungary. Louis Kossuth is involved. There's a revolution in Baden. There's a revolution in Prussia. But by the next year, 1849, and especially by the 1850s, you have the return to power of a new group of conservatives, and the middle class and working class no longer exercise control over the European countryside and European urban areas as they had briefly in 1848. When we look at Marx and Engels, we notice they collaborate a number of works and also operate separately. The major work of Marx is, of course, the Das Kapital, three-volume work, dealing in detail with the emergence of capitalism, the development of capitalism, the overthrow of capitalism, the nature of the economic system, the limitations of the economic system, the contradictions of the economic system. He completes volume one. Engels is the key figure in organizing and publishing volumes two and three after the death of Marx in 1883. When we look at Frederick Engels, we're looking at a man who is a partner of Karl Marx, but in essence, a junior partner. He supplies wealth, income to the Marx family, to the daughters, to the sons-in-law, to Marx, to his wife. Without that, Marx would have been even more destitute than he was. His health would have been even worse than it was, and his life expectancy would have been shorter than it was. So in that sense, he's an important figure. He's also a co-author with Marx of a number of works, most notably the Communist Manifesto. He also has his own works, deals with women, explains how the gender inequality emerged, explains how in the new society there will be greater gender equality as well as class equality with the proletariat in charge. You have then a partnership which produces an international orientation as well. Not only the Revolution of 1848, Paris Commune of 1870-71, but the First International, 1864-76, which Marx battles against his opponents, Proudhon, but especially Michael Bakunin, a Russian anarchist and revolutionary. Marx most likely wins this contest. Marx and Engels are very combative, very aggressive, very assertive, and this is shown by their dealings with those who oppose them or are not on the same page. Moses Hess, Michael Bakunin, and others suffer the wrath of Marx and Engels. What's going to happen is that when Marx dies, Engels will take over, live till 1895, be supportive of the family of Karl Marx, particularly his daughter Eleanor. Eleanor will emerge as a figure of peripheral importance, marginal importance. She will marry Edward Aveling, who's got talent, but is also a misanthrope and a womanizer and a little bit lazy. She will support workers, support unions, support Marxism, eventually commit suicide. So the story ends on a rather negative note. But in the meantime, due to the efforts mainly of Marx and Engels and others in Germany, in other parts of Europe, France, Spain, parties, communist parties influenced by the ideas of Karl Marx emerge. Eventually, a communist party will emerge in the United States in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution. The First International, which will topple in New York City in 1876, will eventually be replaced by the Second International, more moderate socialist. Marx's influence is much less than that. Marx also deals with race, although it's not a key component, as it is not a key component of Europe as compared to the United States. He supports the Union during the Civil War, supports American nationalism in a sense, supports the American workers, writes columns with the aid of Engels for the Tribune, published by Horace Greeley in New York. So he's a journalist, he's a scholar, he's an activist, a socialist, an ethicist, a practitioner of scientific socialism. He parallels his work with Darwin in some respects. But he's also romantic in a sense. He's also an idealist, an ethicist, a humanitarian, a humanist, an atheist, and part of the Jewish protest tradition. What can we say in conclusion? To look at Marx and Engels, we're looking at two of the key creative figures of Western and even global social philosophy, social activism, social thought. They were a pair for four decades. They transformed the landscape, eventually, of Europe and other parts of the world. They also raised the issue of family. They both had families, parents, wives. In a sense, Engels had children. They were Marx's children, but he worked with them. He helped them. He was, in a sense, Uncle Friedrich. So when we look at families, we often think of the nuclear family, extended family, but Marx and Engels were a sense of family. They didn't live together, but they lived close together. They visit each other frequently. Engels made food available. His house was open to Marx and family. His house was the center of intellectual and activist activity. Eleanor Aveling was a favorite of Engels as well as of Marx. Her death was a blow to the movement and a blow to the family. But at least the tradition continued through them and through others who saw themselves in the tradition of Marx, neo-Marxists. One of those who eventually saw himself in Marxist terms is William E. B. Du Bois, William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, an American social activist, an American historian, sociologist, author, academic, taught at Atlanta University and other places. He will be the subject of the next presentation. That'll be the first of three presentations on African-American leadership in the 19th and 20th centuries. The concentration will be on the 19th century on Frederick Douglass. In the 20th century, we will deal with W.E.B. Du Bois and conclude by introducing again Martin Luther King Jr. Then we'll turn to African-American women, give an overview of African-American women, beginning with Stewart, Marina Stewart, who was the first native-born American to speak before mixed audiences, a male and female, very controversial. She was doing this at about the same time as Frances Wright, and prior to the Grimke sisters, Angelina and Sarah. She's at the same time as David Walker, Thomas Skidmore, Frances Wright, George Henry Evans, Robert Dale Owen, Robert Owen, and others. We'll start the story with her, carry the story from Marina Stewart, Maria Stewart, to Ella Baker, who was a key figure from 1930s into the 1960s and 70s, worked with Martin Luther King Jr., was part of the NAACP, was a godmother of the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and she was the one who called on the students who participated in the sit-ins at lunch counters to form their own organization rather than being a junior counterpart of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. That's where we're headed. For today, there is no more to say. Thank you very much.